Okay, since this is a class, not a formal discourse, I don't begin with the Namo Tassa. Last time I gave an overview of the organization of the Pali Canon and also a description of some of the background conditions that were taking place in India that served as some of the background conditions out of which Buddhism arose. And now we can go directly into the study of the suttas themselves. And the first sutta that we will be taking is the 26th discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses, called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search. And this sutta, I think, is especially useful as a choice with which to begin, because first it provides a kind of biographical sketch by the Buddha of his own search for enlightenment, and also it lays down in very clear terms the basic motivation of the spiritual quest according to the Buddha's early teachings. And as we study the sutta, we'll take our explanation of it up to through paragraph 18, where the Buddha describes his attainment of enlightenment. Then at that point, we will stop temporarily with this sutta and then examine some other suttas in which the Buddha describes his quest for enlightenment from different angles. So in this way, we get a kind of series or multiplicity of perspectives on the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment. We're able to look at it from different angles. Okay, so this sutta begins, well, every sutta begins with the words, "Thus have I heard," in Pali, "Evang me sutang." And according to tradition, these words were spoken by the Venerable Ananda at the first Buddhist council. According to the account of the First Council, found in the Pali Canon, also in other sources, at this council, the disciple of the Buddha named Mahakashyapa was like the president of the council. And there were two monks who were especially well known for their mastery of the texts. One who was the master of the Vinaya, or monastic discipline, was Venerable Upali. And so Venerable Mahakasapa called Venerable Upali up and questioned him about the Vinaya, or monastic discipline, and Upali gave the explanations, and in this way the earliest form of the Vinaya Vitaka was established. Then Mahakasapa called the Venerable Ananda up and questioned him about the discourses or sutras. And Venerable Ananda answered the questions of Mahakasapa. And each time he began to relate a discourse of the Buddha, he would begin with the words, "Evang me sutang," "Thus have I heard." And so these words have become something like the seal of authority or seal of authenticity to indicate that these suttas have been heard by Venerable Ananda. And who is this Venerable Ananda? Venerable Ananda was a relative of the Buddha, perhaps a cousin, and a very close disciple. During the first 20 years of the Buddha's teaching career, he didn't have one regular attendant, but he would select different monks to serve as his attendant, to look after him, take care of him in the course of his wanderings. But after 20 years, when he reached the age of 55, then he felt that he needed a full-time permanent attendant. And he asked the monks to select an attendant from their own midst. Many monks volunteered, but the Buddha didn't accept their offer. But the one monk, Ananda, remained quiet. But the Buddha knew that this monk, Ananda, was the one who had the qualities that he wanted. So then he asked Ananda to serve as his attendant, and Ananda agreed to do so. And so through the last 25 years of the Buddha's life, the Venerable Ananda attended constantly to the Buddha. He would serve him from early morning even to late at night, sweeping out his cottage, preparing his water for washing. When the Buddha fell ill, he would look after the Buddha. When the Buddha wanted to address the monks, Ananda would call the monks to a meeting. Ananda was very efficient in organization. Whenever the Buddha would give him instructions, he would be able to implement those instructions exactly as the Buddha wanted. He was always very precise, very careful in what he did. He was very skilled and diplomatic in dealing with people, able to reconcile when there were tensions or conflicts between groups of monks. He was always skilled in reconciling them, bringing them together again. When monks or visitors wanted to see the Buddha, they would always come to Ananda for an appointment, and Ananda would arrange the Buddha's appointment schedule. And Ananda had another extremely valuable gift as too. And this was an incredible memory, a memory which was able to retain whatever he heard. So whenever the Buddha gave a discourse and Ananda was present, Ananda would listen to it and preserve it in his memory. And when the Buddha gave a discourse and Ananda was absent, then Ananda would come to the Buddha later and ask him to relate any discourses that he had missed. And after hearing them, Ananda would bear them in his memory. So in this way, within the Buddha's teaching, Ananda came to be designated what is called the Dhamma Bhandagarika, which means the treasurer of the Dhamma. And because he was the treasurer of the Dhamma at the first Buddhist council after the Buddha's passing away, Ananda was given the task of reciting the sutras to the whole assembly so they could fix the first version of the Sutta Pitaka. Okay, and on this occasion, coming back to the text, the Blessed One, that's the Bhagava, or the Chinese translated as though it were read, the World Honored One, was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. Again, I'll give a little background here. First, Savatthi. Was a city in northeast India. Shravasti, located here. To get some idea in relation to another place. This is Varanasi. Bodh Gaya, the site of the Buddha's enlightenment, is here. Lumbini, the place where he was born, is here. So Savatthi is actually quite close to Lumbini. And when you read the suttas time and time again, you learn that the discourse given by the Buddha took place in Jeta's Grove in Savatthi or Anathapindika's Park. Now, after the Buddha attained enlightenment when he started his teaching career, very soon after he gathered disciples around him, he came to the city of Rajgir, Rajagaha, which is here, because he had a friendship before his enlightenment with King Bimbisara, and he promised King Bimbisara that after he discovered the truth, he would come back and teach in Rajagaha. And so the Buddha first started teaching in the city of Rajagaha, and King Bimbisara presented the Buddha with a monastery, which was called the Bamboo Grove, Veluvana. And in the very earliest days, the Buddha and the Buddhist monks didn't have any kind of dwelling place, but they would live under trees, under the shelter of rocks, in groves, or out in the open air, sleeping on the ground. But there was one wealthy householder, wealthy merchant in the city of Rajagaha, who came and saw how the monks were living, and he offered to build cottages or huts for the monks. And so he set up some huts, and he became a supporter of the Buddhist order. And this merchant of Rajagaha had a brother-in-law living in Savatthi, whose name, given name, was Sudatta, but who is better known by the name Anathapindika, which means, it's a kind of epithet, which means one who is a generous supporter of the poor and the helpless. Of course, this Sudatta was a very generous, very compassionate man. And one day, Sudatta came to visit his brother-in-law in the bamboo in Rajagaha, and there he met the Buddha. And he was so impressed by the Buddha that he invited the Buddha to come to his own city of Savatthi. And the Buddha accepted his invitation. And before the Buddha arrived in Savatthi, Anathapindika went back in advance, and he purchased from the prince Jeta a grove outside the city of Savatthi, and there he established a monastery for the monks. And the Buddha came to this monastery and was very appreciative of it. And during his teaching career, he would stay at this monastery very often. And during the last 20 years of his life, he spent almost every rains retreat, with a few exceptions, in the monastery built by Anathapindika. In Savatthi, there was another great supporter of the Buddha, a woman whose name was Visakha. Her given name was Visakha, but she was known popularly as Migara's mother. And she built another monastery for the Buddha in Savatthi to the east of the city. And this monastery was known as the Eastern Park, or also as the palace of Migara's mother. And when the Buddha was staying at Savatthi, he would generally alternate between these two monasteries. If he spent the night in Anathapindika's monastery, then in the afternoon he would go to spend the afternoon in the monastery of Migara's mother. And if he spent the night at the monastery of Migara's mother, then he would go to spend the afternoon at Anathapindika's monastery. Okay, so this is some of the background information to the unfolding of this sutta. Okay, so the sutta opens one morning when the Buddha, as usual, dresses, and then he takes his bowl and outer robe, and he goes into Savatthi on alms round. During the Buddha's lifetime, the Buddha himself and most of the monks would get their daily food by taking their alms bowls and going on alms round. And when the Buddha was gone, then a number of monks came to the Venerable Ananda and told him that it's been a long time since we have heard a Dhamma discourse, a Dhamma talk from the Buddha's own mouth. It would be good if we can get to hear such a talk. It seems that these monks are not so personally close to the Buddha, and so they're hesitant to come directly to the Buddha himself, a little reserved. And so Ananda is the great facilitator, the intermediary between the Buddha and the community of monks. And so they come to Ananda and ask him if he could make some arrangements so that they can hear a discourse from the Buddha. Then Ananda knows the Buddha's daily routine, and he suggests that they go to the hermitage of a Brahmin named Ramaka. I don't know any further information about him. And they agree. Okay, so then the Buddha goes on alms round, takes his meal, and then in the afternoon he goes with Ananda to the Eastern Park, the palace of Migara's mother. And then they spend the afternoon in meditation. And in the evening, the Buddha emerges from meditation, and together with Venerable Ananda, they go to take a bath in the bathing place in the eastern part of the park. And while they're bathing, then Venerable Ananda suggests to the Buddha to go to the hermitage of the Brahmin Ramaka. And the Buddha, Ananda drops a hint by saying it would be good if the Blessed One would go there out of compassion. In other words, he's indicating indirectly that there's some compassionate purpose that would be served. And so then the Buddha goes to the hermitage of the Brahmin, finds the monks there engaged in a discussion on the Dhamma. He asks them what they are speaking about, and they tell him that they have been having a discussion on the Dhamma that was interrupted. A discussion on the Dhamma that was about the Buddha himself. And then the Buddha praises them for speaking about the Dhamma, and then he gives his famous words of advice. He says, when you gather together, monks, you should do either of two things, either hold a discussion on the Dhamma or maintain noble silence. But you should avoid, this is by implication, engaging in worldly talk, such as people are ordinarily prone to talk about. The text mentioned is a standard list of 32 topics of worldly talk. Maybe I could find them in another sutta, just to give you some idea of what one should not be speaking about. Talk of kings, today that would be politics, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, battles, food, drink, clothing, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, countries, women, heroes, streets, wells, the dead, trifles, the origin of the world, the origin of the sea, whether things are so or are not so. Today I think we could amplify this list many times. I found this in Sutta 76, very close to the beginning. Okay, and now the Buddha begins his formal discourse by speaking about two kinds of search. We could call this two kinds of quest. The Pali word is the word of the title, pariyesana. These are the noble quest and the ignoble quest. And now it's part of the standard procedure in the Buddha's style of giving a discourse is that he usually begins with the negative side first and then comes to the positive side of the teaching. This is, we know even in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha begins with suffering and the cause of suffering. Then he comes to the cessation of suffering and the path. When he speaks about karma, he begins with bad, unwholesome karma, then comes to wholesome karma. That's a fixed procedure of the Buddha. I think in order to show what is to be avoided, to get the bad side out of the way first, then to show the positive side, what one has to cultivate. Too many interpreters of Buddhism fasten only upon the negative side, and then they say that Buddhism is negative. But if they're a little more patient, then they will see that after the negative side comes the positive side. Okay, so here the Buddha begins with the negative side. And he says, what is the ignoble search? Here someone who is himself subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. Someone who is himself subject to aging seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being himself subject to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. And so here this is a kind of radical statement of what we call the contingent nature of the world, that everything in the world is subject to birth, aging, sickness, death. And to pursue these things, to seek after these things, to build one's life up upon the acquisition, the accumulation of these things, is to engage in an ignoble quest. And then the Buddha raises the question, and what is it that is subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and so on? Here, he says, wife and children, men and women slaves, these are all the kinds of possessions that would have been typical of a well-to-do person in that particular period. Goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephant, cattle, horse and mares, gold and silver. Today we could again change the list. Nice house in the country, cars and yachts, private planes, computers, a lot of furniture, luxurious possessions. And though the Buddha here includes wife and children along with men and women slaves, goats and sheep, one has to understand here that he's speaking from a very radical standpoint of one who is seeking the final absolute goal of the spiritual life. But the Buddha doesn't ask his householder or lay disciples to give up their families, and that they command them all to enter on the life of renunciation. But for those who are living the household life, he gives the appropriate instructions, including to husbands, instructions on how to look after their wives and children, and to women, how to take care of their husbands and children. But here the Buddha is speaking from the standpoint of his own decision to enter upon the life of renunciation. And then, after enumerating these things, he uses a very important word which cannot really be satisfactorily translated. He says, these acquisitions are subject to birth. The word here, acquisitions, is a very key word in the suttas. The word, the Pali word, is upadhi. Upadhi, perhaps the best translation, would be assets, things that one acquires, accumulates, and uses as a basis for building up one's sense of personal identity. Philosophically, the word upadhi comes to be extended in meaning. At the grossest level, it will mean things like material possessions, sensually enjoyable possessions, material possessions. But then it comes to mean also the five aggregates, the panchakanda, things that one identifies with and clings to as the basis of one's personal identity. And then it also comes to include the defilements that cause one to cling to things and use them as a basis for personal identity. And so the Buddha says that these acquisitions, here he's referring basically to the material possessions, are subject to birth, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. Then the same is said about what is subject to aging, subject to sickness, subject to death, subject to sorrow, subject to defilement. Except that there's a few little differences, that gold and silver are not said to be subject to sickness, subject to death, subject to sorrow. They're said to be subject to defilement in the sense that they can be corrupted, to corroded. Okay, so all of this, the seeking after things that are subject to birth, aging, sickness and death, sorrow and defilement, all of this now at the end of paragraph 11, all of this is said to be the ignoble search. The search for things that deflect one away from the ultimate spiritual goal. And now the Buddha sets out to explain the noble search, the Ariyaparyasana, the quest that is undertaken by the spiritually noble ones. Here, someone who is himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nirvana. Similarly, being himself subject to aging, he understands the danger in what is subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, subject to death, himself subject to sorrow, himself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. And here, again, there's a key word, a key expression. The key expression is the one that's translated, having understood the danger, adinavam viditva. Here the word adinava could have the sense of, it's translated danger, but has a sense of unsatisfactoriness, deficiency, inadequacy, faultiness, and the faultiness in all conditioned, contingent phenomena is precisely that they are subject, of course, once they're born, they're born, but once they come into being, then they grow old, decay. If they're living beings, they fall sick, they die, or if they're material things, they perish. If they're living beings, they experience sorrow, and they become defiled. And opposed to this, beyond all of this, the Buddha here is affirming the existence of a reality, a transcendent reality, which is not born, has no coming into being, it never grows old or decays, never, once one attains it, or at least, of course the Buddha falls ill as well, but that state itself is a state of security from illness. It is a state which is deathless. It never perishes. It's a state when one attains it, one is free from sorrow, free from defilement. And the Buddha calls this the supreme security from bondage. Here I wrote the Pali. It's a very nice expression in Pali. Anuttara Yoga Kema. Anuttara means something without anything superior to it, unsurpassed. Yoga here is not yoga in the sense of meditation practice, but the state, the meaning of bondage. And kema is the peace and security that comes when one is liberated from bondage. And so then the Buddha sums up and says that to set out, to leave behind all of these worldly enjoyments that are bound up with birth, aging, and sickness, and death, and to go out seeking the unborn, the deathless, this is the noble search. And in this way, the Buddha is addressing the monks, and he's sort of encouraging them in their own decision to have left the household life and enter upon the life of renunciation in order to make the effort, the supreme effort, to attain the deathless. And now the Buddha goes back to speak about his own experience in seeking enlightenment, in seeking liberation. And so the Buddha here, he says, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, and here the way the word bodhisattva is used in the ancient texts, the Buddha uses it generally to refer only to himself in the period before his enlightenment in this life, or even sometimes to refer back to his previous life before he took rebirth into his final existence. So while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, he's speaking that he was just like an ordinary person, being myself subject to birth, I sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I also sought what was subject to these things. But then he thought to himself through his own, we say through his own intrinsic wisdom, he stopped and questioned himself. Why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, and so on, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement. And now the idea occurs to him. Suppose that being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger, the deficiency, the inadequacy, the faultiness in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. Suppose that having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, I go out and seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. I'm always very moved by this passage, and it strikes me, you know, we have, on the one hand, we have this very glorified story of the Buddha that we read about that comes through the commentaries, where the Buddha is living in super luxury, that he's never before seen or heard about old age, sickness, and death. He thinks everybody lives forever. Then one day he wants to go out for a journey outside the palace. His father tells him, stay, don't go out. But he goes out anyway. Then for the first time he sees an old man, sick man, dead person. And he doesn't even know what these things are, what condition these people are in. But that seems to be like a sort of later legend. Its roots are in the canon, even in the Digha Nikaya. But that seems to be a kind of legend which has been developed to represent in visual or pictorial forms what is actually a psychological experience, a kind of inner awakening or maturity. And here in this sutta and in other texts of the Majjhima Nikaya, we have the Buddha's experience of awakening to the facts of life and going out in quest of liberation, given in very clear, realistic, psychological terms. And also what impresses me very much about this passage, as well as the suttas as a whole, is really how modern they sound. Like if you take the Upanishads, which are the last part of the Vedic collection, which were composed perhaps 100 years prior to the time of the Buddha, maybe even some of them contemporary with the Buddha, and you read them, and they're steeped in such heavily mythological way of thinking, heavily ritualistic way of thinking, or symbolic way of thinking. But the Buddhist texts, which just 100 years later, maybe even the same time, being composed at the same time, and it seems almost as if they could have come from 21st century America. So direct, clear, and realistic. Okay, so now the Buddha has made this decision to go out and seek the undefiled supreme security from bondage. And so sometime later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life. From other texts, we learn that when the Buddha made this renunciation, he was 29 years old. And he was married, and his wife had just given birth to a child, a boy. Though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So now the Buddha has left the city, his native city of Kapilavastu. According to other sources, he's left with his charioteer. They've crossed the river. He's heading south into from Kapilavastu, probably coming to the area. Bodh Gaya is here. He would have been perhaps traveling in this area around here. And at this time, when the Buddha made his renunciation, this was a period, as I explained last week, when there would have been great numbers of young people who would have been inspired by this, who would have seen into the unsatisfactoriness of worldly prosperity, sensual enjoyment, who would have had some intuition of some state of liberation or deliverance beyond the bondage of the world, and would have been actively seeking that attainment through various ascetic and contemplative practices. There would have been communities of ascetics and meditators who would have gathered around famous spiritual teachers, learning their systems of philosophy and their meditation practices. And so when the future Buddha, the Bodhisattva, went out on his own quest for enlightenment, he didn't strike off like a proud person seeking all on his own to gain enlightenment, but he would have inquired, who are the great teachers around at this time? Yeah.
Is there anybody at that point who had claimed to have achieved these things, the Supreme Security from bondage?
From the Buddhist texts, it's hard to say that there were such people, but from other texts, it seems that the founder of famous teacher of Jainism, Mahavira, known as Nigantanathaputta, would have been claiming to be a liberated one, since he was teaching disciples as well, probably before the Buddha. But from the Buddha standpoint, we would say that he wasn't actually enlightened and liberated.
Right. Yeah. I ask it because, it has to occur to him that possible.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to,
yeah.
Life's just filled with ignoble pursuits, and that's all it is.
Yeah. No, I think he would have had a very clear sense when this was the quest in which so many had set out. And perhaps there were teachers who were claiming to have reached that enlightenment. But this, it's not really possible to say with certainty by deducing from the text. But anyway, let us continue. That he would have heard the reputation of one teacher whose name was Alara Kalama. And he went to this Alara Kalama and told him that he wants to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. And this is a quite significant expression. I think it's sort of backread into the text from the Buddha's development of his own system. Since the Buddha uses this expression to describe his own teaching as consisting of a Dhamma, which is the doctrinal teaching, and a discipline, Vinaya, which is more than just a set of monastic regulations, but Vinaya, discipline here, I think has the broader sense of a system of spiritual training. And so the Buddha comes to this famous teacher, Alara Kalama, and asks to lead the holy life under him. And Alara welcomes him, and he praises his own teaching. He says that this Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and dwell in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. In a way, this seems to imply almost what the answer to your question, that it seems that one can attain liberation through this doctrine. And so the Bodhisattva now quickly learns the Dhamma. But what he learns now is the theoretical aspect of this teaching. Unfortunately, there's no actual record in the text, the Buddhist text, of what was the philosophy that Alara Kalama was teaching. But after learning it, being able to recite the teaching, repeat it back, speak authoritatively about the philosophy, the Bodhisattva was not satisfied. And he thought that Alara, the teacher, doesn't speak about realization merely through faith alone. Certainly, he has seen the truth of this teaching for himself. And so then the Bodhisattva goes to him and asks him in what way he has attained realization of this teaching. And then in reply, Alara explains to him the state called the base of nothingness. Now this needs a little explanation. Okay, within the Buddhist system of samadhi meditation, the meditation which develops through the development or strengthening of concentration, 8 stages of meditative absorption are recognized. The first 4 of these are called the 4 jhanas. We will come to them in time. Then above the 4 jhanas, there are 4 higher stages of samadhi or concentration, absorption, which are collectively called the formless or non-material attainments. The first of these is called the base of infinite space, because in this attainment one experiences the sense of the infinity of space. The second is called the base of the infinity of consciousness, because in this attainment one, the attention shifts from space to the consciousness which is aware of space, and one experiences consciousness as being boundless. In the next stage is the base of nothingness. And in that stage, one focuses upon the insubstantial or the empty aspect of consciousness. Not, this is not in the sense of Buddha sunyata, but just in the sense that in consciousness there's nothing solid, no material substance to it. And so then the mind becomes absorbed in this sense of substancelessness or intangibility. And that is the base of nothingness. Then beyond this, there is one higher stage called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And so, apparently, Alara Kalama was a very skilled yogi, meditator, and through the development of samadhi, he had attained the base of nothingness. And he probably thought that this attainment was meant enlightenment, liberation, release from the round of birth and death. And now when the Bodhisattva received the instructions on attaining that base, the base of nothingness, from Alara Kalama, he made an effort to attain it. And because he had very strong paramis or spiritual perfections from many lives, many past lives, he quickly entered upon and dwelt in that Dhamma, in that state, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge. And so then he goes to Alara Kalama and reports his attainment to him. And Alara Kalama must have been a very noble-minded man. He doesn't get jealous and envious and think, how come this young upstart reaches the same attainment that might have taken me 20 or 30 years of meditating in solitude to attain? But he's very happy and joyful. And he says, it is a gain for us, a great gain, that we have such a fellow living the holy life with us. He tells the Bodhisattva that you have attained exactly the same realization, the same state that I have attained. You know the Dhamma that I know. You're just like myself. And now the last line on page 257, he says to him, come, friend, let us now lead this community together. In other words, he's now appointing the Bodhisattva on the level of being co-teacher with him, his fellow teacher, even though the Bodhisattva has just very recently come to him. So continuing, the Buddha says, thus Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But now the Bodhisattva has some sense that this attainment is not really the final goal, is not equivalent to the realization of Nibbana. And so he reflects, this Dhamma, that is the teaching of Alara Kalama, does not lead to disenchantment, that is a sense of the unsatisfactoriness of the conditioned world, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana, but only to reappearance. The word actually means rebirth in the base of nothingness. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, disappointed with it, I left. And here I have to explain. When one attains any of these eight meditative attainments, and one masters that particular attainment, the four jhanas or the four formless attainments, at the time of death, if one has not gone further into the development of panya or wisdom, if one becomes satisfied with that samadhi, that meditative absorption, enjoys it, and becomes attached to it, at the time of death, then one will take rebirth into a plane of existence that corresponds to that particular attainment. The Buddhist cosmos is divided into many different levels or strata, which operate, we call them at different vibrational frequencies. It's not that these other realms are someplace thousands of miles above the earth, but rather they are different spheres of consciousness. And actually, in a sense, material manifestations of the corresponding state of consciousness. So we are in the human world because our karmic consciousness brought us, was operating at a certain vibrational frequency for this human world to manifest before us. Similarly, an animal has a consciousness which works at a very close vibrational frequency with ours. And so we see, the animals see the same world that we do. But now the devas or gods in the heavenly worlds, their consciousness works at a different vibrational frequency. So they see and experience their world as a heavenly world of beautiful sights, celestial music, lovely food to eat, beautiful parks and gardens to play in. But we're struggling down here to make a living. But those who go beyond even worldly, ordinary, meritorious deeds and gain very deep stages of samadhi, their consciousness works at a very different vibrational level. And so when they die, then they will take rebirth into the realm that corresponds to that meditative attainment. And they'll live in that realm sometimes hundreds of years, thousands of years, until the powerful, virtuous karma that brought rebirth into that realm loses its force, its momentum. And then they pass away from that realm back into another realm as determined by their karma. And so the bodhisattva would have been aware, somehow, I guess, through his highly developed wisdom, that by mastering the meditation of the base of nothingness, he would have been reborn into the objective realm called the base of nothingness. And according to the Buddhist texts, life in that realm lasts for, I think it's 60,000 kalpas. Now, one kalpa, the Buddha illustrates the length of time that one kalpa takes. If there's a mountain of granite, solid granite, I think it's 7 miles high, 7 miles circumference, and a man passes by once every 100 years with a piece of fine cloth and just strokes it once. Then a century later, somebody else comes, strokes it once. That mountain will wear away before the kalpa is finished. Okay, so a kalpa must be, I can't believe it's that long. It's probably only 17 billion years, something like that. Yeah. So 80,000 times 17 billion, it's a long time. But when you're there, it's like, wow, I'm in the base of nothingness. What's for dinner? Then a few days later, it's like the alarm clock goes off, and you wonder, what's that about? And somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, guess what, buddy? What? Get out, your time's over. Then you have to step out and fall down and maybe come back to the human realm. And maybe find yourself born in a little village someplace in India, maybe having to work as a rickshaw driver. Okay, so maybe we will pause at this point. If there's any questions, any comments.
Question. Yeah. Last week you were talking about what was going on at the time with the Brahmins.
Yeah.
And you talked about that their religious thing was rebirth in the heavenly world. Did they talk at all about these formless realms, or was this something exclusive to the Sramana philosophers?
I think that there probably would have been Brahmins who would have been influenced by the Shramanic way of thinking. Within the Vedas themselves, one wouldn't have found any mention, I think, of these meditation practices and these higher realms of existence. But there would have been, I think, a fair amount of interaction between some of the more intellectually sophisticated, more forward-thinking Brahmins and those in the Shramana culture. In fact, there are some conjectures among scholars that the Upanishads actually took shape through the impact of the Shramana way of thinking upon those in the Brahminic community. Yeah. Well, I think clairvoyant people are able to see things that might be at a great distance in this realm. I mean, in the human world. But to see these other realms, it would be more than an ordinary type of clairvoyance. But perhaps those with what is called the divine eye, the divachakku, would be able to see into these other realms of existence. Though I have to say the formless realm would be rather difficult to see, even with the divine, I think it would be impossible to see with the form eye, with the divine eye, because there's no form there to see. It would just have to be intuited with the mind. Excuse me? A knowing. There would be a knowing of it. Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't mean it in that sense. It's not because the teaching of non-self or sunyata in that particular Buddha sense. This is a unique discovery of the Buddha. But this is, it's called nothingness in the sense that when it attains the base of the infinity of consciousness and one focuses upon the aspect of consciousness that there's like nothing that one could get a grip on there. There's the absence of any kind of material substance in that, in consciousness. And so by shifting the focus of attention from consciousness itself to the immaterial, substanceless aspect of consciousness, then the mind moves from that base of infinite consciousness to the base of nothingness. But these attainments are reached purely through the strengthening of the faculty of samadhi or concentration, not through insight or wisdom, which is why the Buddha, in order to reach enlightenment, as we will see, he had to strike out in quite a different direction. Any further questions? I think the expression still point maybe is a very vague expression. It could it could signify like the initial quietening of the mind out of which the higher attainments eventually come into reach through the stilling and collecting of the mind, then the mind builds up the strength, the composure needed to enter the absorptions. But the expression still point itself is a little vague. Excuse me? Signless, that's coming into a different... Yeah. Okay, then I think we'll stop now and we'll continue next time. I think I might get up to the end of 18 next time. If so, it might be useful also if we can to bring in sutta number 4 next time, beginning from what I'll focus on is the passage in sutta number 4. From paragraph 20 to 33. Though, as I said, it doesn't hurt. That's just a few pages, the sutta. You could read the whole thing.